Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, Seth talks to writer Michael Lewis, who also takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
President Trump, as we mentioned, is on a 12-day trip to Asia, dominated by trade negotiations and North Korea's nuclear program. But even when Trump is abroad, he can't seem to escape the escalating Russia investigation. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump's trip got off to a rough start on Friday when he flew to Hawaii, which is, of course, the state where former President Obama was born. And Trump's motorcade was greeted by protesters lining the streets, reminding him of his past as a birther, with signs like this one that read, "Aloha, POTUS. Welcome to Kenya." Solid burn. And the interesting thing about the word aloha is that it means both hello and go f*** yourself. But, of course, sarcasm doesn't work great on Trump because there's a good chance he saw that sign and thought he was actually in Kenya.
See, I was right. I knew Obama was born in Kenya. I just didn't know that Kenya was in the United States. I'm learning stuff every day, you guys.
However, Trump did get a warmer reception once he landed in Japan, where he was greeted by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, a key ally. You might remember that when Abe was in the U.S. earlier this year, he stayed with Trump at his private club, Mar-a-Lago, and even crashed a wedding there. And Abe was apparently eager to give Trump just as warm a reception.
The president and the Japanese prime minister shared a moment that they showcased their bromance. Take a look here. When Mr. Trump landed, Mr. Abe surprised him with customized baseball hats. The white caps have gold lettering that say, "Donald and Shinzo make alliance even greater."
Abe is a smart man. He figured out that the only way to communicate effectively with Donald Trump is via hat. Which actually gives me an idea. I think that left was on enough for him to read it. Also, the hat said, "Donald and Shinzo make alliance even greater." That sounds like what you say to a monkey if you were teaching it sign language. Human and ape make friendship stronger. But whether Trump is the man in that exchange or the ape, or more likely a combo of the two, his Asia trip will be focused in part on dealing with the threat of North Korea's nuclear program, which has the region on edge. North Korea has already shot missiles through Japan's airspace that landed in the Pacific Ocean. And as the situation intensifies, allies like Japan are very much looking to the U.S. for leadership. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like Trump is capable of providing that leadership because over the weekend, the Japan Times reported Trump questioned Japan's decision not to shoot down the missiles when he met or spoke by phone with leaders from Southeast Asia countries over recent months. The U.S. president said he could not understand why a country of samurai warriors did not shoot down the missiles. Okay, there are about 54 things wrong with that, but let's just do three. One, Japan hasn't had samurai warriors in hundreds of years. Two, they famously carried swords, so if the rockets were more than, like, 8 feet off the ground, good luck. And three, anybody who watches movies knows that samurais were white guys. Also, can you imagine that phone call?
So you don't have samurai? Have you guys considered karate guys? They could chop the warheads off. I did a drawing of how I think it would work. It's stick figures, but I think you'll get the idea. And last resort, obviously, you could use Godzilla, but I know things usually backfire when you let him out. No, I saw it in a documentary.
Now, Trump's trip comes amid growing concerns among the American people with Trump's handling of the North Korea crisis. A new poll out this weekend found that 67% of Americans don't trust him to act responsibly in handling the situation involving North Korea. And I'm not sure Trump is doing very much to ease their concerns. In an interview Sunday, Trump seemed almost like he was caught off guard when he was asked if there was anything in particular he can do during this trip to deal with the North Korea crisis.
Do you think there is work you can personally do on this trip that will lessen the threat?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to see what happens.
How can you be unprepared for that question? It's the whole reason you're there. That's like Eli Manning being asked, hey, how come you guys lost? And him going, oh, I hadn't even thought about that. Look at Trump's face. That's the face of a man who did not realize he was actually expected to work on this trip. He's like a teenager being asked the day after a field trip what his favorite part of the art museum was and proudly saying it was getting high on the bus. But of course, even when he's getting ready to jet halfway across the world, Trump cannot seem to free himself from his obsession with Hillary Clinton and the Russia investigation that seems to be getting closer and closer to him. He tweeted obsessively on Thursday and Friday about a series of manufactured Hillary scandals that he felt the Justice Department should be investigating. And before he left for his trip on Friday, he made clear to reporters that he was angry that the Justice Department and the FBI had so far refused to go after his political opponents.
I'm really not involved with the Justice Department. I'd like to let it run itself, but honestly, they should be looking at the Democrats. They should be looking at Podesta and all of that dishonesty. They should be looking at a lot of things, and a lot of people are disappointed in the Justice Department, including me.
I love how he says he's not involved with the Justice Department and then immediately tells the Justice Department what to do. Trump's a catty teenager who's in a fight with her best friend. I'm not involved with Becca, but she should be careful with Justin because that boy is shady AF. So we now have a sitting president demanding that the Justice Department prosecute a political opponent. Trump and the GOP are trying to claim that Democrats somehow broke the law by funding research that led to that infamous dossier. So what's Trump's evidence for that claim? If you listen closely, he's very vague about where he's getting his information.
The origins of the dossier supposedly is conservative funding. What does that tell you?
Well, I heard the other day that it might be, and then I heard that basically they started something, but the Democrats really took it up and started it. I have a feeling that the Democrats started it. The amount of money that I hear being thrown around is ridiculous. Somebody said that this guy Steele that wrote it, and we'll figure that out eventually, that he paid money to the Russians. I think the firm was involved with many people. I don't have to mention names, but I heard they were involved with John McCain.
Somebody said, I heard, I have a feeling. Trump has access to the best intelligence in the world, and he gets his info by peering through the blinds like a nosy neighbor.
Our Japanese neighbors just moved in. I bet they're samurai.
In fact, Trump often seems confused and at a loss to explain where he gets his information. Take, for example, the terror attack last week in Manhattan. Trump called for an immigration crackdown and claimed that the suspected terrorist brought in 23 other people with him. But when he was pressed on the veracity of that number, even by Fox News, he could not explain where he heard it.
I mean, just take a look at him. 23 people, potentially 23 people.
Is that verified?
It's what I heard. It's what I gave. Whether it's 23 or whether it's 2, as far as I'm concerned,
it's a big difference.
Okay, no, I know that, but I hear it's 23. It's a lot of people.
Look, we all know 23 and 2 is different. 23 is 2 plus 3.
But he just keeps saying stuff without evidence and expecting us to accept it. If Trump were a magician, he would end tricks by looking into a hat and saying,
yep, there's a rabbit in there. There wasn't, and now there is. You have to take my word for it, but there is. What a nice trick.
Of course, Trump and his allies on the right are dredging up a series of manufactured Hillary scandals in order to muddy the waters and distract from the very real Russia investigation, which has now snared three of Trump's former campaign aides and seems to be getting closer to the president himself. And Trump isn't exactly doing a great job of sounding like he has nothing to hide. Just listen to how defensive he sounds in this interview from Sunday.
Look, all I can say is that I have nothing to do with Russian collusion. Nothing whatsoever, and everybody knows it.
Do you think you would ever consider trying to have Mueller removed, or have you pledged to just stay out of that?
Well, I hope he's treating everything fairly, and if he is, I'm going to be very happy, because when you talk about innocent, I am truly not involved in any form of collusion with Russia, believe me. That's the last thing I can think of to be involved in. As far as I'm concerned, I have been told that we're under investigation. I'm not under investigation. You know, when it comes to Russia collusion, they're looking at the wrong person. Absolutely the wrong person.
In the span of 20 seconds, Trump's defense went from there is no collusion to I'm not involved in any collusion to I'm not under investigation to you got the wrong guy. If Trump were ever called in for questioning, he'd crack immediately. Where were you on the night of the 14th? Certainly not robbing a bank, but I'll bet Hillary was. Now, who knows what the investigation will ultimately find, but every time Trump is asked about alleged Russian collusion or his former aides who are indicted, he finds a way to sound cartoonishly guilty. Take, for example, his former foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos, who pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his extensive contacts with Russians. Trump sat in a meeting with Papadopoulos during the campaign, and it's a meeting Trump should remember vividly, given that just over a week ago, he bragged that he had
one of the great memories of all time.
Well, you'll never guess what Trump had to say about that meeting with Papadopoulos.
I don't remember much about that meeting. It was a very unimportant meeting. Took place a long time. Don't remember much about it.
So I think I figured it out. Trump has such a terrible memory that he forgot he has a terrible memory and therefore thinks he has a great memory. He should get a memento tattoo saying that. In fact, the Papadopoulos meeting isn't the only thing Trump has conveniently forgotten about his own presidential campaign. There's also his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, who was indicted for, among other things, acting as a secret foreign agent without declaring his status to the government. Last year, Trump's campaign fired Manafort once his ties to Kremlin-connected politicians in Ukraine started to get media attention. But now, suddenly, Trump can't seem to remember what that was all about.
What was it that convinced you that he had to be let go?
Well, I think we found out something about he may be involved with certain nations, and I don't even know exactly what it was in particular.
So the guy with one of the great memories of all time suddenly can't remember why he fired his campaign chairman in the middle of a presidential election. If Trump had been taking a polygraph during that answer, it would have looked like his signature. So we have a president unprepared to deal with international security threats who's sounding increasingly authoritarian and calling for the prosecution of his political opponents. Meanwhile, the special counsel's investigation has already snared three of his former aides and seems to be closing in on more of them. Mr. President, do you really think you'll make it through your full term?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to see what happens.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is a journalist and best-selling author of books like Liar's Poker, Moneyball, and The Big Short. His latest, The Undoing Project, is available now in paperback. Please welcome back to the show Michael Lewis, everyone. So happy to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back.
So this is a very interesting book, especially in the time we're living in. But you wrote this book about two Israeli psychologists who basically changed the way we think about decision-making and the human mind.
They're Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics in 2002, even though he knew no economics, because what they had to say about the way the mind worked infected economics and created a whole field called behavioral economics. But they were two guys who kind of basically fell in love with each other's minds and with each other without the sex.
Uh-huh.
And
that doesn't complicate it then. Then you can actually get work done.
Well, yeah. Well, that's exactly right. And the children were ideas.
Yeah.
And so they set out to figure out, like, what the mind's doing when it doesn't know, when it's moving through the world and it's uncertain, it's making judgments. So for this, so my book Moneyball is where this all starts.
Right.
Right? So Moneyball is about this baseball team that figures out that experts in judging baseball players don't know the value of baseball players. That if you come in with statistical analysis, you can find these mistakes they make. They undervalue players who don't look right. Mm-hmm. They overvalue players who are good looking. They overvalue things that are really vivid and so on and so forth. And what I didn't get to in that book, that I get to in this book, is what these guys basically explain why all that happened. Like, what was going on in the mind of the experts when they screwed it up. So that was the thrust of all their work is, like, the systematic mistakes human beings make when they're trusting their gut.
And one of the things is they believe the human mind is thirsting for certainty, even though we live in an uncertain world.
Absolutely. So what they'd say is, like, after something happens, you tell a story that makes it sound as if it were inevitable. Mm-hmm. That the world, that the mind wants to make the world seem a much more deterministic place than it is. Amos Tversky had this lovely line. He said, it was just scribbled in one of his notes in his file cabinets. He said, reality is not a point, it's a cloud of possibility. But people want to make it a point. So after Donald Trump wins,
yeah,
nobody sees it coming. Then everybody pretends they saw it coming. And then before long, there's a whole story about how it was inevitable. Mm-hmm. You know, he loses by 3 million votes, and yet still it was inevitable kind of thing. It's a crazy thing. And so the very people who couldn't have predicted it start to tell a story about why it was so predictable. And these guys' point, it's very human. Their point is that, like, we're being too hard on ourselves. Like, much of life is this way. It's random. There's a lot of randomness. We don't know. We actually can't predict what's going to happen. So don't get all worked up about the fact you didn't see it coming.
It's a bit of a coincidence you're here tonight because we've been working on that piece about Sam Clovis for a while, but actually some of the
quotes... So you didn't just rip me off?
We did rip you off, but it was by accident. Yeah, it was on purpose. We just didn't think you'd be. But you did a lot of the reporting on the USDA. You wrote a long article in Vanity Fair about it.
Which is not an obvious subject.
No.
The Department of Agriculture.
It's not.
So here's the thing. The Obama administration essentially created the best course ever created in how the federal government worked. They prepared, by law, they're required to prepare for the transition. And they deputed like 1,000 people to spend the better part of a year to briefing books and briefings that the day after the election into the Department of Agriculture or the Treasury Department or the Department of Energy. 20 or 30 people for the new administration would come in and learn how the place worked. Nobody showed. The student didn't show for the class. So what I've been doing is going and getting the briefings. So I went into the Department of Agriculture just to see, I didn't know what it did, and to see just how terrifying it is that they don't know anything about the thing they're running. They didn't bother. And as you say, they start appointing people who, like Sam Clovis, and like that list of people you described. I mean, you got to see the resumes, it's even better. I mean, like, you know, the skills, like that where it says skills on your resume, one of them listed is their only skill, a pleasant demeanor. So this is who we're saying, it is this sense that, like, it doesn't matter who gets put in the job. That guy, Sam Clovis, that job that he was put in to do, you're supposed to be distributing $3 billion a year in research money to scientists, agricultural scientists, who are basically doing things related to climate change, like how we're going to grow food in a different climate 50 years from now. Very long-dated research that the private sector wouldn't do. The woman he replaced, a woman named Kathy Wotecki, had spent the better part of 50 years learning and preparing for that job. She was a distinguished scientist. If you're going to take this guy who, like, is a right-wing talk show radio host who doesn't know anything about science and stick him into your administration because you helped you win Iowa or whatever, why put him in there? I mean, like, put him someplace where you don't need to know anything. There are plenty of places in government where that's true.
Yeah, I believe it.
And so why do that? It's a great mystery.
You said there was a drinking game that the USDA employees played.
Yes, it was called Does the USDA Do It? Because it's such a complicated, sprawling place that even the people who work there don't actually know all the things it does. And if you guess wrong, you chug. But, I mean, if I told you some of the things it does, I mean, like, believe it or not, there are people who are around airports in America shooting fireworks at geese to make sure they don't live near the airports so they don't fly into airplanes. The USDA polices, actually, all disputes between animals and people in the country. Now, you think they're not many, but, you know, puppy mills and circus elephants that get abused, and we kill 9 billion birds a year to eat in this country, and they have to inspect every single one of them. I mean, it runs the Forest Service, it runs all of rural America is dependent on that place. It subsidizes water, electricity, schools, firehouses. And at every point in the place, it's like a big part of the social safety net. There are people there working who are there not because they can't think of anything better to do with their lives. They wanted to work on, say, hunger in America or on poverty in rural America. I mean, the point of my piece about this place was, like, it really matters why you're doing the job. If the answer is money or like status, and it's not has nothing to do with the actual job, you're going to get a really different kind of performance out of that person.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad. It's one of the things we're missing with everything else going on. I'm so glad you wrote that article, and it's always so great to have you. Give it up for Michael Lewis, everybody. The Undoing Project, available now in paperback.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm backstage with Michael Lewis, who's enjoying a well-deserved glass of Pinot Grigio after his interview with Seth. I want to ask you about reporting on the Trump administration, because you also reported on the Obama administration. As a journalist, what are the differences reporting on the Trump administration?
Well, the Obama administration was very open. It was easy to the extent where, I mean, I just called them up out of the blue. The press secretary and said I wanted to hang out with the president and write a piece about what it was like to be president. And everybody around him said, no, you shouldn't do that with a journalist. And he said, ship it in, because he was unafraid of who he was.
Right.
And there was no sense that you had to stage manage him in any way. Whereas Trump feels, it all feels very artificial and kind of phony. The people who are working in the federal government under Trump are terrified right now. So they don't want to, I have interviewed lots of career civil servants who were there. And basically, none of them want their names used. They all want to kind of explain what's going on and are horrified about what's going on and are embarrassed. So people who are, I'd say probably as a rule, the people who are most trained for the jobs they are in the federal government are the most ashamed about what's going on now. So you talk to scientists at the Department of Energy or Department of Agriculture, they can't believe that they have people overseeing them who say like climate change is a hoax and we should politicize the research and all that. So there's I'd add to that, this is kind of like a management dysfunction that wasn't present during the Obama years. It's not that everything was perfect during Obama. This don't look like inefficiency and all that stuff.
Sure.
It feels like we've gone from a basically pretty well functioning operation to chaos.
Right. You know, it's interesting. You write a lot about data information, how people process that information. When you think about your reporting at the USDA, they're not misinterpreting data. They're actively rejecting it. They're actively rejecting science for ulterior motives.
Yes, that's true. The ulterior motives, I asked myself, like, why would you bother to reject the climate change research, especially if you're directing $3 billion of agricultural research that is supposed to be a response to climate change? And I think the answer is that it wasn't just the Department of Agriculture. It was the Department of Energy, any place where there might be something done that would damage the interests of the fossil fuel industry. Or threaten it in some way. And that at the bottom of it was this economic interest of fossil fuel people who had glommed onto Trump and Trump saw as his allies and supporters. And Trump, the logic of his administration, to the extent there is one, is that, anybody who is blindly loyal to me, I'll pursue their interests, whether it's in the interest of the country or not. Mm-hmm. And anything Obama was for, I'm against.
That's the driving motive, it seems, of his presidency.
Yeah.
It's rejecting anything Obama did.
I think part of what's going on, it's only part of what's going on, is that seeing a black man as president of the United States drove some percentage of the country crazy. And Trump tapped into that very early on. The white resentment towards black success and the threat to white status of the rise of black people. Mm-hmm. And so when he sings that tune, like, I'm going to take apart whatever Obamacare or whatever it is,
sure,
even if it's not in the economic interests of the people.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because it makes them feel good that they're attacking Obama.
Absolutely. Right. That's what he came to power.
That was part of it.
Part of
it.
Sure,
you have
true.
To acknowledge, though, just to muddy the picture a bit, I mean, there are like 24, 26 congressional districts that Obama won twice and that Trump won. Mm-hmm. So it's not all just racism. It's in the stew of whatever Trumpism is.
Right. But let me ask you about your books. I was really wondering, so many of your books have been turned into movies. I'm wondering what that process is like for you, how involved you are in the process, and if it's strange to see actors taking on these characters who are real people who are alive.
Right. So there've been three, The Blind Side, Moneyball, and The Big Short.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty recent phenomenon in my writing life. I mean, it's what Blind Side was maybe 6 years ago or something like that. So the first rule of Hollywood is that they would prefer writers to be dead. That they don't, the author, like from their point of view, the author adds nothing but trouble.
Uh-huh.
You're going to meddle. You're going to like complain about how they ruin your work of art. Mm-hmm. You're going to, you don't actually know how to make a movie. So you're they're going to have to pretend to be interested in your advice without actually taking your advice.
Yep.
And I picked that up early on that I wasn't really supposed to be a part of this, yeah. But it was embarrassing. It's also at the same time, they don't want you feeling insulted. Mm-hmm. So there's this delicate dance that goes on where basically they pretend to be interested in what you think, and you pretend to believe they're interested, and then everything's fine, and they just do what they're going to do anyway.
Yeah.
I've been unbelievably lucky in the talent that's been attracted to the books.
The best actors working in your films.
Yes.
Hands down.
A lot of my favorite actors have been in my movies.
That's great.
Yeah. But the directors have been great, and the writers have been great. Yeah. It's just all been so good. And I've seen so many, you see so many movies that just aren't that good. Maybe not bad, but just kind of, And all these movies just popped. They all did well. And they all felt when I saw them, so how did I feel seeing these characters put on the screen? As a rule, the actors have been creepily similar to the actual people. And how they do it, they don't really want to talk about so much, but the one of the odd things to me is like Christian Bale can become Michael Burry on the screen having spent all of like 8 hours with him. And I spent a year with Michael Burry, and if you asked me to do an impression, I couldn't do it. And even more than that, because you know, the audience doesn't know what Michael Burry is actually like. So there's no real, it's a funny thing that they feel compelled to bring across the actual person on the screen. But they bring him across Sandra Bullock as Leanne Toohey, Steve Carell as Steve Eisman, Brad Pitt as Billy Bean, Christian Bale as Michael Burry, Ryan Gosling as Greg Lipman. They, over and over, they see what they see are like the ingredients of the actual person that are actually very important to the story, yeah. and bring those out in ways that are just incredible. And so just from a distance, the movie business, like Hollywood, seems like a lot of nonsense. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people kind of think it's like fluff and celebrity. The interesting thing about that business is how many great craftsmen there are in it. Writers, uh-huh. directors, actors. Like there's a reason we're the best in the world at it. These people are national treasures.
Last question I wanted to ask you is about your specific writing process when you're writing books. I always like hearing how writers kind of work on their craft. You do something very interesting. You listen to music, which is quite common for writers. You listen to songs I wouldn't expect Michael Lewis listens to while he's writing. So, I'm putting you on the spot here, but please
so you know, because you know enough, you're just not, you're being too polite to tell people what I
listen
to. I want
you to tell people.
You want to tell people that I listened to Jesse's Girl and Stacey's Mom back to back.
Back to back.
And then I wrote a whole book to Let It Go from Frozen.
How does that help? Like, why those songs?
Well, I actually will hear a song and I'll think that could work.
Uh-huh.
And in my soundtrack that I play over and over on a loop when I'm, and I actually build a soundtrack for each book.
Oh, that's fascinating.
But it's not for that interesting a reason. Mostly they're very up-tempo songs that you don't have to listen to that closely. And what happens is it kind of like drowns out everything else. Mm-hmm. So that for me, it's a funny state of mind you're in when you're writing.
Yeah.
And part of the state of mind had always been for me. I mean, right from the very beginning when I was 24 years old writing magazine pieces, is I needed to feel like there wasn't the possibility of interruption. So late at night, I used to write just really late at night from like midnight till 6 a.m. And that was great. Now I have little kids, I can't do that.
Yeah.
So I substituted putting on headphones and playing this music that drowns out everything. So I just don't hear anything. Mm-hmm. And so that's the purpose of it. However, I can't deny I'm listening to this music. And it's funny, I'll be moving through the world.
Yeah.
And like I'll hear Jesse's Girl and I'll go, time to write. I had this like this Pavlovian response to these sounds.
That's fantastic. Well, it's working. I'm glad it's working. You've written some of my favorite books and some of my favorite films. It was such a pleasure having you here. And keep up the great work, especially at Vanity Fair. These pieces on these different agencies at, under the Trump White House are fascinating. So thank you for doing your work.
Thank you.
It was such a pleasure.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.